radioalburn.com.
Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 29th of November, 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live tonight at radioalbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good evening, sir. How are you doing?
Good evening. I've never quite liked the name Black Friday. I don't really thought of that one, but
yeah,
does it stick with me?
Weird, isn't it? I don't know why that is. Why would they call
Very
it
weird.
That?
Well, you tell me, because whoever thought of it, you know.
Maybe all I can think of is Back in Black. You got red, haven't you? You got red, which is like overdrawn or the bills are overdue, and then you've got black, which means you're not overdrawn. You're not having to take out a loan. That's all that I can possibly think of. Black Friday. Black Friday.
It sounds demonic to me, but, you know.
Well, I did hear that it was something to do with, because it's when all these shops and they have a sale on and all these blacks converge on them and have a riot, yeah. And that's why it's called Black Friday, because the blacks like to riot on this particular Friday. I haven't heard much of it, though.
A bit of footage is the past in that, yeah. Took a war over a big box.
Yeah. Yeah, more than a tug of war. I think there's been hospitalizations over trainers and things like that. But that's all been overtaken today, though, Dennis. It's been overtaken today. We've got we've had a terror attack in Britain.
I believe so. Yeah, I believe so. I caught a newsflash, which again brings the question of why do we let them in?
Yeah, and why do they go after the people that pointed out? I mean, it is so obvious, isn't it? I mean, everybody knew that this was going to be an Islamic terrorist, and the BBC was saying, well, we haven't heard for certain that it's a terrorist attack, and the police guy's going there, he's saying, we're investigating it, and we're treating it as a terrorist attack, and the BBC are going, well, it's not definite yet, is it? I think it is now.
Well, that is the BBC.
And I
have to tell you, though, I've been... All week, I've been listening to the interviews of a guy who I used in Masonic Victory once or twice, James Perloff, and he is the closest historian to my work. And I later heard in an interview that he watched The Greatest Story Never Told. And he has some fascinating information, whereas where I'm producing videos, he brings out documents from books and everything. And I can recommend him to listeners. That's James Perloff. He's even half Jewish, so that, you know, they can't even call him anti-Semitic. But his work is more or less parallel to what mine has been, and more even. He explained the Vietnam War, where America took 14 years and got beat, whereas it took on Japan and Germany and won in 6 years. So that was always a puzzle to me. And, you know, false flags. He was saying that with Churchill being head of the Admiralty at the time, World War One, he more or less put the Lithuania, you know, the ship what got sunk with all the explosives.
Lusitania.
That's the one. Put it in harm's way. So we can credit another 1,200 dead to Mr. Churchill.
Yeah, the Germans said, look, you know, it's against the law for you to put munitions on these ships. It's very, very dangerous. If any of these ships come near us, you know, we have to fire at them, because if they come through and they're full of all these ammunitions, those weapons are going to be used against the Germans. And they took out adverts in the American press for 6 months before the Lusitania sailed, saying, look, this is what will happen if any of these ships come near us. And don't put any civilians on these ships. And what did America do? They loaded it up with civilians, loaded it up with ammunitions, and sent it off to the Germans. The Germans quite rightly shot at it. And it went up, and they went over there to rescue the seamen, which is what you do. If you fire on one of these ships, you go straight over to pick up any of the seamen that are in the lifeboats, and they couldn't get close enough because it was like a firework display, because it was all loaded up with this illegal, unlawful ammunition.
They actually fired one torpedo.
Yeah.
And in World War One, they weren't really, they weren't that big. And so normally, an equivalent ship would take 5 or 6 torpedoes, 7 maybe, to take it down. Whereas they fired the one, they only had 2. They fired the one, they kept one back because they had to get back to Germany. They kept it back just in case. So one torpedo, but then, like you said, the old ship went up like a firework display. But what I didn't know, what Churchill had done beforehand, he put on merchant ships and other passenger ships, he'd actually put weapons on it. And so if they saw a sub, they would either charge it, crash into it, or they would drop all these sides where the guns were hidden, and suddenly you had artillery firing at the submarine. So the Germans really didn't have much choice, because that ammunition in particular were going towards killing German soldiers.
Well, he's breaking the rules of war as well by armoring civilian ships and loading them up full of weapons and loading them up full of ammunition. All of that is against the law. And if they're going to start firing on the U-boats from these civilian ships, they've got every right to fire back at them and fire just first at
Winston
them.
Winston, to think of that one, eh?
Yeah, all these dirty tricks that were played during the war, but at least they're getting exposed now. Carolyn Jaeger was reprinting these old magazines on our website by German expats just before World War One. It was a pro-German magazine or newspaper that was produced in America, and that had all the details on that, on the lead-up to the Lusitania being shot at, and it had all these details saying, look, this is what's going on, this is what the American population need to be aware of. But then once America entered into the war, it had to change its name and it couldn't continue. But that was one of the only places where you could actually get information from Germany was in this magazine. Was it in the First War or the Second War when Britain cut the telegraph cables, and that was the first bit of the war, so that Germany couldn't communicate with America? I can't remember if it was the first one or the second one.
Probably the first one, because the second one, it's possible, because anything what came out of Europe was controlled by the Rothschilds, and they probably did the same in the first. So I would guess at the first.
Yeah, shocking stuff. Shocking stuff. Anyway, we've got the last section of Goebbels' book, Those Damn Nazis, to look at tonight. We've looked at why we are nationalists, why we are socialists, why a workers' party, why do we oppose the Jews, and tonight the final one is revolutionary demands. And once again, it's not what you would expect. You think revolution, you think Bolshevik revolution, French revolution, you think violence, rioting, lots of blood being spilled, and that wasn't what they were talking about at all. They were talking about a revolution of the spirit, as we will see. Do you want to comment at all on it before we get into it, Dennis, this little series that we've done?
Well, I think a lot of people are enjoying it, that's for sure. And one of the big things is showing the difference in the socialism as well, because this people today are still fooled by the word socialism. They just won't accept it, especially in America. And they think that the National Socialists, we're no different to the Marxist Socialists. So,
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Everybody thinks of socialism today and they just think, oh, Marxism. But back then, it wasn't quite like that. Socialism was very popular in Germany. So they used the term socialism because they wanted to be popular. And it wasn't so much about Marxism as it was about the rights of the worker. And they were all about the rights of the working man. So they used the term socialism, as we explained, but the way they put it, it could only work when it's limited to the nation. We can't have international socialism. That's what brings down communism. You know, some of it is good ideas. Look after the worker, have communication between the worker and the boss, and do what's best for the nation. That's all good ideas. But you can't then start including everybody else in that and say, well, your loyalty as a working class man needs to be a working class man in Colombia or a working class man in Mexico. Your loyalty as a working class man needs to be to the upper class man in your own country, and vice versa. He needs to be loyal to the working class man in his own country. And then socialism works. And that's national socialism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't need class warfare. We need
class cooperation. Yeah.
No, well, this is it, isn't it? They set up guilds that they had, and you had the best people at the job or in the various different aspects of whatever industry it was, and they would all be a part of this guild, and they would all be communicating and talking together and working out what was best, and the very best of the members of these guilds would then go on to form part of the government, rather than, you know, people voting for MPs. They would have best people.
We've seen the result of that.
Yeah. I mean, look at the scramble they're into today, trying to bribe as many voters as possible to vote for them. That's what it's all about, isn't it? Just bribing them. Look at Corbyn. Free internet, free gas, free electric, free rail. Well,
it wouldn't be so bad if they kept it a promise.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, as they say, you'd have free everything for 10 minutes with Labour.
Yeah.
And then the Tories will spend the next 10 years in austerity trying to pay it all back.
Yeah.
What we need is just a nationalist politician, just someone to
speak for
our interests. Yeah, that's it, our interests. They talk about all these different communities, different community interests. Labour bring out their race and faith manifesto. You know, it's got nothing in it about the white race or the British race and the British races, you know, English, Welsh, Northern Irish and Scottish and their interests. Nothing about that at all. It's all about the other races, the other communities. You know, that's what I'd really like to see, is just some mention of the white community, you know, treating us as we are, as a community.
Even Christianity would help every now and again, just to hear the word.
Yeah, well, they've infiltrated that, haven't they? Justin Welby and his best buddy, the chief rabbi of Britain, this Minerva, they've just brought out a pamphlet scolding the British church, basically, and saying that they've got to listen to the Jews, listen carefully to them. Any bits in the Bible that the Jews don't like, they've just got to ignore them or correct them and teach the correct interpretation, which has been given to them by Jews. And, the rabbi gets the last word. He gets the afterword.
That's a shock to me.
it tells you who's in charge, doesn't it, in the Anglican Church. Anyway, let's get into this final part in Goebbels' book then on the revolutionary demands.
Okay.
He says, "We do not enter Parliament to use parliamentary methods. We know that the fate of peoples is determined by personalities, never by parliamentary majorities. The essence of parliamentary democracy is the majority, which destroys personal responsibility and glorifies the masses. A few dozen rogues and crooks run things behind the scenes. Aristocracy depends on accomplishment, the rule of the most able, and the subordination of the less capable to the will of the leadership. Any form of government, no matter how democratic or aristocratic it may outwardly appear, rests on compulsion. The difference is only whether the compulsion is a blessing or a curse for the community." Well, there's loads there, isn't there? I mean, first off, he's pointing out the difference between democracy and aristocracy. And democracy, you've got you're ruled by the mob, you're ruled by numbers, and the majority are always the least qualified to decide on something. The people who are qualified to do something are always in the minority, because they're the ones that have worked very hard, they've got a very high IQ, that they've studied whatever the subject is, and they're qualified to comment on it. But the majority aren't. And the majority who pick up all their politics from the newspapers and from the television, they're just going to vote the way that they are told to. So it's effectively just mob rule. instead of having people that have earned their, you know, earned their right to be in charge.
Yeah. I think it's the quickest way to divide a nation. When you've got 51% ruling over 49, it doesn't bode for harmony.
I think we've really seen that with the Brexit vote as well, haven't we?
Yeah, certainly.
Because people have been taught to, you know, to vote for their thing, like to vote Tory or to vote Labour and to stick with it. And, you know, that's not the way it should be. You should have somebody that's in charge, and he convinces everybody else to go along with his plan. See, so it's unanimous. And if you have somebody whose say goes, I mean, you're going to end up having to obey him anyway, but the best way of doing it is someone has the final say and they try to persuade everybody else to go along with it. Do you know what I mean? So you get support.
It's a little bit like a football manager. I mean, you know, every now and again you get a great football manager like, say, Alex Ferguson and Bill Shankly, you know, and they control that club and they take it on a destiny and they stand and fall by decisions and results. And if it doesn't work out, then somebody else is brought in. But, you know, that isn't democracy. That to me is a way to run both a football club and the country.
Well, if you have democracy, you've got somebody different every 4 years, haven't you? So nobody can be held responsible by the time...
Never settles, yeah.
Yeah, by the time the policies of the last government have ruined one portion of the community, that government have all retired. And you've got a new one then there now, and they say, well, it wasn't us that did that. It was the ones before. And they all just use that excuse, and nobody takes responsibility. And this last bit that he says here, the compulsion can either be a blessing or a curse for the community. I mean, if the government is doing right by its people, then the compulsion is going to be seen as a blessing. You can think, well, I'm glad that I pay out 10% of my earnings because it's spent wisely. We've got a good health service that's just for us. We've got free tuition for our young people that are bright enough and that deserve that. It's not wasted on foreigners. It's not wasted on people who haven't got the ability to actually do that work. So then it's a blessing. When it's 20% of your wages or 25% and that's going on all the foreigners and you have to queue for months before you actually get in to see a doctor, then it's a curse. That compulsion becomes a curse. And it all depends on what the people in power are actually doing. And this is what Goebbels is saying here. You know, the state should be there to look out for the people. It should be run on the best system. And if it's running on the best system and it does what it's there supposed to be there to do, then it's going to be a blessing to its people rather than a curse to its people.
Well, the prime example of that is the number of photographs we see of German crowds flocking with the biggest smiles on their face every time Hitler stands up in a car passes by.
Oh, it was amazing to see, wasn't it? I mean, they will try and say today, oh, those were staged pictures. You can't stage pictures of children, you know, running up to politicians.
Well, I found some footage on Fit for the Grace tour, never told that I'd never seen before. And although, you know, it wasn't you know, as clear as I would have liked, I had to use it because there were just mobs and mobs of them trying to get to that car, just in a joyous atmosphere.
You know what they say? They say to actors and politicians, you know, never work with animals or children because they will always, you know, sort of do the opposite thing. And yet there are all these pictures of Hitler with both of them.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, they naturally knew that this was a good man. And
they can sense, can't they? They can sense.
Well, children can. I think it was Obama tried to kiss a child and it screwed its eyes up and started screaming. I've seen that happen a few times with these politicians. Never really seen that happen with Hitler.
Awful. Yeah,
he was a saviour to the children.
Biden.
Have you
seen that
clip
when he's with that little girl?
Ooh, creepy Biden. There's quite a few of them, isn't there? Sniffing women's necks.
That child could sense something.
Well, I think the German children, I think they could sense how good Hitler was because look what he did for them. He stopped them from being aborted. And he guaranteed that they would be born into healthy bodies with healthy genes, without congenital diseases, without congenital deformities. He saw to it that they would be born with the best potential they could possibly have, so they weren't born mentally retarded. I mean, what kind of an amazing gift is that to give to the unborn children. I'm going to guarantee that you're born into a healthy body and you're able to live to the fullness of life. Whereas today, we say, oh, no, we can't possibly have that. We need to have mental retards and people with diseases, and we need to let them breed because it would be against their human rights if they weren't allowed to breed and have a child themselves. And you got things like people with Down syndrome having children.
Well, it's funny you should say as well, because I've noticed lately, Telford's one place, there's been some other places as well, where babies are dying in hospital and mothers are dying as well. And we're not a third world country yet. So something's going on. I mean, there was an instance of a young lad who was in a hospital and was starved. He didn't eat for 5 days. And when he went down to the operation table eventually, as the lift door shut, his father was looking at him and he said to his father, am I going to die? And his father said, no, 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 no. And he died.
We are really falling behind with medicine here, aren't we? And we've got huge waiting lists. We've got people waiting on trolleys instead of being able to actually get in to have the surgery. We've got huge waiting lists in Wales and in Scotland. They're charging people for medicine in England for their prescriptions. They have to pay, and yet the medical service is falling apart. And the reason for that is because it's just been flooded with foreigners. You got foreigners coming over here from Africa, 8.5 months pregnant, just deliberately coming over so that they can give birth in Britain. And not just from Africa, from lots of different places, because it would cost so much money elsewhere. It's becoming an international health service.
It'd be interesting to know what colour these babies are, because they never actually say.
Well, I think we know they're going to be brown, aren't they? They outbreed us, don't they? Mohammed is the most common name.
I'm saying the ones that are dying.
Right. That would be interesting to see. We do know that the doctors that are most likely to be struck off for gross incompetence and are non-white. And the majority of the cases for gross incompetence are non-white doctors, because they've tried complaining about it and saying, well, it must be racism. Why aren't these white doctors being struck off? Well, because the white doctors didn't bribe their examiner to get the exam, their medical exam at the end of it, and various things.
Interesting to find out.
But if the government looked after its people, then it would be a blessing for the community, and people.
Well, that's
would be
why
happy
I'm asking the question, because we know they don't.
Well, they like to mock places like Syria, don't they? They say, look at these people. They've got these pictures of Bashar al-Assad everywhere, and they're forced to look at them. And out in Libya, they put up the pictures of the dictator. The dictators always like to put their pictures everywhere. That's nonsense. The people want those pictures there because they love their leader so much, because they've done so much good for them.
Yeah.
That's the fact of the matter. Where you see these pictures up, it's because people want to honour the person in that picture. And there were pictures of Adolf Hitler, and they'll say today, oh, he put his picture up in the school and all the children had to worship him.
Megalomaniac, yeah.
Yeah, they wanted a picture of him there because he'd done so much good for the country. He'd got everybody back to work. He'd got the honour back for Germany, and people weren't starving anymore, and Germany was becoming a first world power again after Versailles. All the education available for the kids.
Yeah. Which is why Austria looked on and saw how wonderful the right was doing and voted 99.9% to join. Would you expect anything less?
Well, this just proves it all, doesn't it? It proves it all. So National Socialism was a blessing for the community. Don't forget, this was written in 1929. So that this is Goebbels saying, this is what we're going to do. And unlike most political parties, they did actually go and do it once they got voted in. He says, what we demand is new, decisive, and radical, revolutionary in the truest sense of the word. That has nothing to do with rioting and barricades. It may be that that happens here or there, but it is not an inherent part of the process. Revolutions are spiritual acts. They appear first in people, then in politics, and then the economy. New people form new structures. The transformation we want is first of all spiritual, and that will necessarily change the way things are. And that's what they totally miss out the mainstream when they talk about National Socialism. They will never talk about anything spiritual. They'll say, oh, the brown shirts forced their will on everybody. They were cracking the communists' heads and all of this. But fascism and National Socialism, it was all about the spirit. It was all about a revolution of the spirit and looking at what man is and trying to be the very best that he can possibly be. And there's the doctrines of fascism written by Giovanni Gentile from what Mussolini had to say. And a large portion of that is all about the spiritual side of fascism. And it's Christian. It's when you think of Christianity and it says in the New Testament about how you're all one in the body of Christ and you've got one bit's the eyes and other bit's the hands and other bit's the feet. Well, that's like the nation. And once you realize that and you're all working together, you're so much stronger. And that's what the symbol of the fasci is. It's all those sticks together and that together makes the strong handle of an axe. But all those sticks are of the same kind. They're all made of the same wood. That's how it's able to do what it does. That's where you get the strength from.
You just hit the nail on the head. That's a vote winner if I ever heard one. If a party came out today and said, we're going to crack communist heads, they've got my vote.
Yeah, well, they won't teach people about communism today, will they? They want to teach people about the horrors of the Second World War and how mean the Nazis were. And communism is the threat that we are facing. It's communism. Didn't disappear. When the Iron Curtain fell, because they'd taken everything they could from Russia and they'd managed to work their way through the institutions in America and in Britain. And they were controlling the other part of the world then. Instead of doing it outright, they sort of worked their way in through cultural Marxism. So yeah, well, that's why they won't go against it.
They actually funded Mao after World War II, finished in Europe and Japan, then the war continued in China and they backed communism, the bankers. So, you know, that led to other wars in North Korea and Vietnam, wars which they should have won by rights. They had no right to lose, and yet they didn't really want to win. You know, just another way of getting some laws in back home and letting communism spread abroad, which clearly did.
Well, the communist revolutions where they smash everything up and take charge of it from the private person to being owned by the state, that just served the bankers who had lent out the money for the revolutionaries in the first place. So that just served them, and that was their idea of revolution, was smash everything up and destroy everything and put criminals in charge. The National Socialist way was to get people thinking, and get first off have a revolution of the spirit of the individual. So he gets himself together and he starts acting in a moral way instead of an immoral way. And he looks for how he can help his country and how he can help his nation rather than looking with envy at what the wealthy industrialist has and saying, well, why does he have that and I don't have it? He's no different to me. Men are all created equal. So he must have it because he's stolen it from me. So I'll go and steal it back. That's the mentality of communism. As the National Socialism will say, well, look at that man over there. If he's got all that money and he hasn't earned it through working, then he's a banker and he's earned that through usury. But if he's got all that money and he's an industrialist and he has worked hard for it, then what we need to do is get him to appreciate that he's part of a family and that the nation is part of the family. And we need to encourage him to look after his workers, and we need to encourage the workers to look after the guy that's employing them. You need to kindle that knowledge that the people that are of your nation are related to you. They're part of you share the same ancestors with them. You share the same blood with them, because you're not going to badly treat your own family, are you? So if you can only get people to realize that, you know, the bosses aren't going to mistreat their workers. This is one of the reasons why they flood the place full of foreigners, because there's no loyalty. There's no loyalty between the foreigners and the boss, and there's no loyalty between the boss and the foreigners. The boss can just keep the wages down as low as possible, as low as he can get them. And then he's got these unions that do as they're told, basically. that again, yep. Just trying to stir things up, and the Jews would be stirring up the boss, and they'd be saying, put the wages down lower, you can get cheaper labor from somewhere else. And then they'll be whispering in the ears of the workers and saying, you should be going on strike. He doesn't pay you enough money. And by doing that, you basically drive the wages down, and the people who go on strike end up losing their jobs, and the boss ends up taking in cheaper workers, and the banker ends up rubbing his hands because he's making more profits, and there's more division has been increased in society. So there are two different ways of looking at revolution. And the,
definitely.
And the National Socialist one was peaceful. It wasn't taken over by force. It was taken over through the ballot box and then making the changes that were necessary.
Which they probably stopped today. They probably find ways of rigging elections, as we know. Maybe Brexit took them by surprise, so maybe there's still hope.
Well, this is what they mean, isn't it, when they say, oh, it's a threat to democracy. I think, hey, hang on, how can something be a threat to democracy because people are voting for it?
Exactly.
And this is what they mean, is when democracy starts looking like it's actually going to go the way the people want it to, and it's going to start looking out for the people, then they'll claim that it's a threat to democracy. What they really mean is it's a threat to foreign
power.
It's a threat to foreign influence in the country, because if you get somebody in that is concerned for his people, it's his people he's going to be concerned for, nobody else. They can be concerned for themselves.
I heard something about Hungary the other day where they did something, I can't remember, Viktor Orban, he did something which really amazed me, and was really, you know, true to the country and its roots of it being white and Christian. Slip my mind at the moment, but you know, I'm quite happy with places like Hungary and Poland sticking to the guns.
Well, you've done quite a bit recently. I did a podcast today and mentioned that they've just pulled out of Eurovision because it's homosexual.
That's the one.
Yeah,
that's the one.
And because it's harmful to the mental health of people, homosexuality.
It certainly is.
Yeah, it's great. But
if I see a man with a beard in a dress, that affects me mentally. Never mind children.
Never mind the homosexuals themselves. But yeah, but he's brought in policies to increase the birth rate among the Hungarians. He's banned immigration. Yeah. He's got rid of Soros. He's got rid of gender studies at the universities. Yeah, he's done loads of good. Viktor Orban has. So, these populist leaders, these good leaders, they do rise up, and we need to recognise them and support them when they do. I don't think it's a good idea to just say, oh, well, democracy's over, there's no point supporting anyone. Because, you know, in order to actually get somewhere, people do have to make compromises. But then once they get somewhere, you know, quite high up, then they don't have to make so many compromises. And they can make changes, like Viktor Orban has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started off small and worked his way up to being a prime minister or president, whatever he is.
Right.
This revolutionary act is beginning to be visible in us. The result is a new type of person, visible to the knowing eye, the National Socialist. Consistent with his spiritual attitude, the National Socialist makes uncompromising demands in politics. There is no if and when for him, only an either or an or. And he demands the return of German honour. Without honour, one has no right to life. A nation that has pawned its honour has pawned its bread. Honour is the foundation of any people's community. Losing our honour is the true cause of the loss of our freedom. And it's quite strong words there, isn't it? Saying without honour, someone doesn't have the right to live. But if somebody is just dishonourable all the time, how can they be a functioning member of society if they're dishonourable all the time? Society is going to be dysfunctional.
It's very similar to in the 48 Laws of Power. They have reputation. You guard it with your life because your reputation is something. Reputation could even win wars without even a war being fought. And it's very similar with honour. Once you know somebody's honourable, then you have this impression of how he is. And obviously being honourable, you know, you've got to respect that person. And that is lacking today, without a doubt.
Well, you can work with somebody if they're honourable. If they're going to honour their promises, they're going to keep their word, you can trust them, you know, you can work with them. You can build something with them. But if they're dishonourable, if they don't keep their word, if they break their promises, then they're worse than useless. And, you know, if you had it may be okay for the individual, an individual that can, say, move from one place to another place. So as soon as he wears out his welcome in one area, he can move to another. Might be okay for him.
Has been done.
Yeah, it might be okay for him being dishonourable, but it's not okay for the society. And yeah, and this, you know, this is the thing. This is the accusation that is made against the Jews. They behave dishonourably, and of course, it might be okay for them to do that because they can move from one nation to another nation to another nation, as they have done. They've been expelled 109 times, and then eventually they end up all together in Israel, but they still can't function properly in Israel. They have to get billions in military aid and just in normal aid from America and from Britain. I mean, Israel doesn't actually produce enough to survive. It has to get help from everywhere else. It has to get all its reparations from Germany, from the war and all the rest of it. A society doesn't function if the people within that society don't have any honour. So, you know, that's the difference between us and the Jews, I think.
Yeah, well, I look at it as very much as the Romans, when the Romans ruled the known world then, you know, these conquered countries had to pay tribute, and that's exactly what America and the other countries of Europe are doing to Israel because they won the war.
Yeah, we are paying tribute to them. What is it Voltaire said? To know who it is that rules over you, first find out who it is you cannot criticise.
Correct.
And that's exactly it. The one people we can't criticise. He continues with his demands. In place of a slave colony, we want a restored German national state. The state is not an end in itself for us, but rather a means to an end. The true end is the race, the sum of all the living creative forces of the people. The structure that today calls itself the German Republic is not a way to maintain our racial inheritance. It has become an end in itself, with no real connection to the people and their needs. We want to abolish the slave colony and replace it with a people's state in freedom. Again, there's a lot there. And he's saying that the true end, or what the whole function of the state should be, the improving the condition of the race. And what does it mean by that? It means the sum of all the living creative forces of the people. So everything that the people do, everything that the nation does, the state should be involved in that and trying to get the best out of the people and make conditions the best that it possibly can for that people. I mean, what other possible reason could there be for having a state, for having people leading and having a say in how society is run? The only possible reason for having that could be to improve the conditions of that people. And you can't extend it to looking out for other people, because they need to be looking out for themselves. They will be looking out for themselves.
Exactly true. That's what Germany wanted. They wanted other nations to look at themselves and react in a way that they could rise, just as Germany had done. But that's not racism. That's just purely who it is.
It's just nature. It's just natural law. And then he says, the German Republic is not a way to maintain our racial inheritance. It's not. I mean, it's multicultural. It had Jews in it, and it was just all about making as much money for the state as possible rather than improving conditions for the Germans. So they were selling off the farmland, they were selling off businesses, they were allowing Jews and foreigners into these important positions. So it has ceased to preserve the racial inheritance of the Germans. And he says it had become an end in itself, with no real connection to the people and their needs. So everything was about serving the state and keeping the state going. And that's what this democracy is about, and these parties that fight one amongst another. It's so that they can get to lead the country. And it all becomes an end in itself, rather than we want to get to the top so that we can make life better for the German people. It's we want to get to the top so that we're the prime minister and we're running things. So it just becomes an end in itself. So that's what they wanted to abolish and replace it with as they call it here, a people's state in freedom, which was concerned with preserving the German people in every which way that it possibly could. So he said, it says, we want work and bread for every productive national and blood comrade. Pay should be according to accomplishment. That means more pay for German workers, and that will stop the senseless fighting in which we engage today. And, you know, again, that's what people want, is to be able to work. They want to be able to provide for themselves, provide for their families. They want the feeling that they have contributed, that they are actually worth something. And yeah, these people that are on the dole, you know, there's a high suicide rate, and a lot of that is because people just feel worthless.
You know, well, worse than being on the dole today is you're working and not feeling the benefit.
Yeah, that as well. Or you've got men that don't have a wife, they don't have a family, and again, they feel worthless. You know, men need to have a wife there and children, and that drives them on to achievement, because men were created to look after the family, a wife and a family, and the wives were created to produce children and look after their husbands. And once you take that out of it, you know, the men feel like they're valueless now. And women, you know, they're not capable of doing the things that that men do. And it's just a waste of time and effort, because you have to constantly make exceptions for them. You have to make special laws for them. You have to have diversity quotas for them and all the rest of it, because they're not doing what they're really doing. And they don't feel valued. They say, we're not valued. We're not paid as much as the men. We don't get the same amount of time off. We don't get the same pay rises. So the women don't feel like they're valued either, because they're not doing what they should be doing. The real way for a woman to find value is to have children. The children will love her. Then she'll feel valued.
What is sad, I've got to be honest, if I was, you know, in my teens looking for a wife today, I would be looking towards an East European rather than an English woman, because they've been, you know, indoctrinated over the years. They've got this sense of, you know, that even they, you know, can rule the world, and all these left-wing antics. I mean, in Leeds, for instance, the violence is more from women than it is from lads at nightclubs these days. It's just I don't know, it's an indoctrination, evil indoctrination on women who don't even particularly like ironing these days.
Well, this is what they did in Germany, wasn't it? They encouraged the women to be mothers. And they rewarded them for being mothers, and they taught them how to be mothers. I mean, where are the lessons for mothers today? There aren't any. And yet in Germany, that's what they did. If you were a young mother, you could go and stay for 6 weeks with older mothers, learn how to do motherly things. And while they were away, the other young women in the village would come in, and they would look after the children and look after the husband while the wife was away. And this was a system that the Germans had, and it was a way for housewives to have a holiday and take a break, and also learn how to be a better wife and how to be a better housewife. There was all this encouragement.
How to look after your husband, yeah, simple.
Yeah, how to look after your husband. And you know, and the husbands, for their part, they were all provided with work, with good pay. Building the autobahns, building up the infrastructure, yep. And once
makes them feel good.
Yeah, and once they had more money to spend. I mean, because they got more money to spend, that means you need more products to be built, which provides more jobs. So you have a cycle of continual improvement that they started off, that the National Socialists started off. So that they carried out these proposals that they made. Once they got into power, they carried it out. And of course, the rest of the world was in a depression. So they looked to Germany and, we want some of this. And that's why the bankers decided, well, we're going to have to put this down. We're going to have to nip this in the bud before it gets any bigger. Because it was getting bigger.
The problem today is when a lad leaves school, he's got no prospects. The easiest thing in the world, he sees these other gang members and people, you know, with plenty of money, they've been dealing in drugs, and it takes them down a road which is eventually going to be a car crash. But what alternative have they rather than, you know, get a measly, if they get paid, off the dole? It leaves them no choice. And that in itself is, the government should be held responsible and criminal for it.
Well, what they should be doing is investing in all of it, all of the sides of our people. The brightest should be going to university for free, and the ones that aren't particularly academic, they should be taught trades while they're at school. You know, they're 15, 16, they should be learning woodworking, bricklaying, carpentry, electrical work. They should be learning trades so that they're going to be useful and they're going to be able to earn money doing that. And, you know, so that they can earn good money doing that, and so that we've got educated people at whatever it is they choose to do. You know, if they're good with their hands, they should be educated at what to do with their hands. They shouldn't be told, well, you should be as good as these academics because we want 50% of everyone going to university, and then you start ignoring the academics because you need to spend more time with the people that are good with their hands trying to raise them up, and then the academics don't get the very best education, they don't get the very best time, and the standards drop. And that's where we are today. You know, Tony Blair, he said he wanted half the population to all go to university. You know, what a ridiculous idea. You know, you have to lower the standards, basically, in order to do that.
Coming from him.
And even, I mean, you'd have to do that even if the nation was all white, but let alone with a nation that's now filled with brown and black people with a lower IQ, you know, the standards are going to go through the floor. I forget how old I was. I noticed that, you know, I never went to university, but speaking to people that have been to university, and you think, you know, you don't know any, you know, you really don't know a lot. You don't know the sort of things that I've learned, you know, without even going to college or university. What is it they're teaching people in these universities now? You know, I think since the 60s, the standards of education has continually dropped. And up till the 60s, it was increasing. And it was then that it started going downhill. Continuing here, he says, provide essentials. Hang on. First, provide housing and food for the people. Then pay reparations. No Democrat, no Republican has the right to complain about this demand, for it was first raised by a banner carrier of November Germany, the Weimar Republic, beginning in November 1918. We only want to make the slogan a reality. That's just common sense, isn't it? You need to provide housing and food for the people first before you start paying back debts. And that's what he was saying here. These reparations that were crippling the country, you know, if people couldn't afford to eat and they couldn't afford to heat their houses, how are they going to be able to work to pay back these reparations? You're just going to destroy the country. And that's what the plan was. That's what Hitler had been saying since he was imprisoned. I forget. Correct. The Dawes plan, wasn't it, Dennis?
Yeah, the Dawes plan and then later the Young plan.
And they were just about destroying the country. You have to look after the people first. He continues, provide essentials first. First, we must meet the critical needs of the people. Then we can produce luxury goods. Provide work for those willing to work. Give the farmers land. The German foreign policy that today sells what we have at below market rates must be completely transformed and must focus radically on the German need for space, drawing the necessary power political conclusions. So he had to put the nation at the heart of everything and not sell off land, not sell off businesses if you get into trouble. You just have to say, well, you'll have to wait for that money until we've earned it. You know, you could selling off land and businesses. You know, the idea that we've sold off our electric companies and our water companies and, you know, the rail and everything else. Yeah, and all of it off to these foreign companies when it was British people that built it, and it was built on British land. You know, it was all British labour, British intelligence that came up with these ideas and these designs. And yet it's all been sold off to foreigners. How the hell can that happen? You know, the government are supposed to be there, like managing all our resources in trust for us, to sell them off. Just
because we're corporations, I don't believe it goes to the government. I believe it goes to the corporation board or the bankers, whoever it be. You know, it's a rip off of a country.
Well, that's the usury side of it, isn't it? Because they will say, well, we need money. Why do we need the money? Well, we need the money to get the national debt down. Why is the national debt so high? Because it's got usury in it.
Can't pay it off. Yeah.
because they, you know, they've been paying, they're still paying off debts from the First World War because there's usury added to it. So idea of selling national resources off like that is something that should be against the law. And what the Germans did, they brought back the land, didn't they? For the German farmers.
They gave it back to the farmers and said, your son and his son will inherit the land and you will be given the right to feed Germany.
Yep, you will not be allowed to sell this land on. You'll only be allowed to pass it on to your descendants so that we keep this important land owned by the people, and so farmers have always got land to farm on. And again, this is the most important thing, is that a nation should be able to feed itself. And, you know, a lot of countries now, they can't feed themselves. They rely on trade with the rest of the world. They're importing food from elsewhere, which puts you at the beck and call of wherever it is that you're having to import all these goods from. This is why when Donald Trump puts his sanctions on these countries, it hurts these countries because they can't produce a lot of this stuff for themselves. But in the same way, when they start doing that, places like Russia that have got a lot of resources, that spurs them on to producing everything that they need for themselves, and they become more nationalist and they become more national socialist. And this is the like the America's unwanted side effect of its sanctions, is that it spurs the country on to produce this stuff for themselves. But we should be producing everything that we need for ourselves anyway, as much as we possibly can anyway, and being self-sufficient. You know, that should be the goal. And because then you take pride in everything that's been produced by your country as well. You know, you want to buy something that's British, made by other Brits, because it's going to be the best in the world. Because it's made by your people.
I should be able to save rainwater.
Yeah, you should.
But I'm not.
Well, yeah, they try to claim they own the water, don't they?
Exactly.
Own the water. They've monetized everything. But all these things, you know, we need to be producing what we can for ourselves and making ourselves self-sufficient. And then, you know, we can't be ordered around by anybody else. And this is what the Germans were doing. They were producing whatever they needed for themselves, and whatever they needed from elsewhere, they were bartering for. So they were, what they were doing was they were swapping product that they had created for product that they needed from somebody else. And in doing so, cutting out the middleman and cutting out the bankers. And part of that was the bankers' own fault, because they wouldn't allow the German currency to be exchanged for other currencies. So what the Germans did, they said, well, we'll just use the currency as a value marker, and we'll give you however much currency's worth of goods instead. And the barter system worked really well. And of course, then you start thinking, well, why do we have any other system? Why have we got anything else? Because it's not serving us, is it? It's serving the bankers, but it's not serving us. It's not serving the nation. And nationalism is all about putting the nation first.
Can I just add that by getting rid of God, you know, something like rainwater, which I believe is God-given to everybody, once you get rid of God, then a private company comes in and claims that rainwater as theirs because they're rich enough or powerful enough to claim it. That's another instance, you know, why they get rid of it.
Well, they used to have laws to protect that. I think you're allowed to take wood, you're allowed to take rainwater in certain areas. If you could put up a house before sundown and you could get a fire going in the hearth, then that land was your own. You could fish in certain areas. I mean, bits that were owned by people you couldn't take from, but bits that weren't, it was your right to. I think it was your right to harvest fruit and nuts from the bushes.
Which you'd think is natural, but...
Well, you would think that they, you know, the hedgerows that they have in the towns, they would put up these bushes that produce fruit and nuts, but they don't. They put up things that don't actually produce that. Because in the countryside, you used to be able to walk along the hedgerows and pick all fruit and nuts, blackberries and, you know, cob nuts, and you could pick your food basically for the day, healthy food just from the hedgerows. And they won't do that now. You know, when you buy it all from the supermarket.
Yep.
Continuing here, he says, provide essentials first. We must meet the critical needs of the people. Now, I've done that bit, haven't I? Peace among productive workers. Each should do his duty for the good of the whole community. The state then has the responsibility of protecting the individual, guaranteeing him the fruits of his labour. The people's community must not be a mere phrase, but a revolutionary achievement following from the radical carrying out of the basic life needs of the working class. So the state can step in and say that you're ripping off your worker. You're not paying him enough. And you need to pay him enough so that he can contribute into the economy with the wages that he's got so that the economy can increase. You're taking too much for yourself. So the state could step in and protect the individual from being ripped off by the boss. And I think Hitler had a good idea of what it was like to be poor. I mean, he'd spent time very poor.
He starved, didn't he, at one point? Yeah.
He was in prison for a while. He was homeless, and he'd really worked his way up from, you know, from the lower classes of society, and saw what it was like in poverty, and worked out ways that you could alleviate that. Instead of looking and thinking, well, I'd like to be the rich man on top of everybody else, he was thinking about ways that could alleviate the problems for the people that were lower down in society.
And, well, the feeling that we have in this country at the present time is it's a them v us. You know, there's no unity with the government and the population. It's always a, you know, they think of a means of getting, you know, an indirect tax out of you, or, you know, certain laws which work against you. It's like it's a split community.
And then they try and get you to have loyalty to your country and say, oh, you have loyalty because we all share the same ideas. We all share the same ideas.
As soon as the war, we're all nationals then.
Yeah. Yeah, you need unity. That's what people are yearning for, is for unity and to work as part of a community and part of a society. But you haven't got that. You've got a state that works at, you know, it cannot actually work for the best interests of anyone because it's not working for the best interests of one particular people. Claims to be working for the best interests of everybody. And you're never going to please everybody because of that. It makes no sense at all to have our political systems run the way that they are. The only way that it can actually make sense is if you are another group of people that are actually living within that nation and you've managed to get enough influence to do that to it. I mean, that is, you know, that's why it is so obvious that Jews are running so much of our countries and responsible for so much of it, because the system is set up to benefit them. It's not set up to benefit us. You know, they might use flowery words, exactly. Oh, it's all about human rights and what's best for everybody. That, as I say, you don't actually please anybody when it's, you know, what's best for everyone instead of what's best for one particular people. It just means that these other people that actually haven't invested in it at all, they are the ones that are benefiting from it at our expense.
That's right.
We end up paying for everyone else. He says, a ruthless battle against corruption, a war against exploitation, freedom for the workers, the elimination of all economic capitalist influences on national policy. And that's pretty important there. You know, economic and capitalist influences, you know, they're pretty important. But what really should come first in the national policy is the people, is the German people. That's what's most important. And, you know, in a nationalist state, that's what's put at the center of everything is the nation. Is this going to help the nation or is it going to harm them? Is this going to exploit them? Even if this is going to make a lot of money for one individual person, but is it going to harm the people that are working for him? Is it going to stress them out? In which case, we don't want it. You know, we don't want pornography.
Which is the way
Viktor
Orban is thinking at the moment, obviously.
Yeah, well, he's looking at improving the conditions of the Hungarian people. He says, a solution to the Jewish question. We call for the systematic elimination of foreign racial elements from public life in every area. There must be a sanitary separation between Germans and non-Germans on racial grounds exclusively, not on nationality or even religious belief. So he's not saying we want to kill all the Jews. He's saying we want to separate the Jews from us, and we don't want them involved in civic life. We don't want them in politics. We don't want them making decisions that affect our people. And we want a separation racially. We don't want to say, well, this Jew is claims to follow Judaism and this Jew claims to follow Christianity, because this is a racial thing. This is a biological thing. We need to separate from people, not because of their ideas, but because of their biology, because they're a different people and they have different ways of doing things. We're getting so into this, Dennis, we're actually going over time a little bit here. So we should finish here, I guess, and we'll continue with this next week. So, yeah.
I like the idea of comparing today with that past ideology. Interesting.
Yeah, well, that's what we do. That's what we've done with it so far, isn't it? Is comparing exactly, what's going on today with what's going on back then. So thank you very much for coming on today, Dennis.
No problem.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Truth Will Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
RadioAlbion.com.